Welcome back from the break.
That's right. Depending on where you were, you might have had something to eat, you might have taken a nap, or you might have just crawled out of bed.
There's some people that are staying up overnight just to be able to watch this, which is great.
I'm impressed by that, you know.
I do have to ask, though, if our producers could go and throw up a timer on there. We don't have a timer to us to stay on track because we have so much stuff to cover. This next little section, we're going to be talking about networking, and it's actually going to be one of the shorter ones.
Yep.
Because there's not a lot of stuff to actually show.
No,
right? So this is mostly architecture and discussions and architecture designs and stuff like that. We've got a little bit of a video that we're going to be able to show you of an actual demo that took place because we don't have access to the hardware to be able to do some of the stuff that we wanted to be able to show off. So it's going to be slightly different for the way that we present this particular section. We just finished wrapping up the previous session, which was on virtualization, and that easily could have gone the entire day.
Certainly could have. The thing to keep in mind with the networking in Windows Server 2012 is that a lot of the enhancements in networking were kind of focused around two things. Number one is multi-tenancy for data centers, and that's where the Hyper-V network virtualization component comes in.
Big player.
And that's a fairly complex thing, and not something that you can do in, you know, 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And you need quite a bit of time to really and truly understand it. And that being said, we're going to do a little bit of try and explain it to you guys in a way that you know, it was once explained to me and I kind of went, I get it now, I know what it's doing, and I understand why and how I'd use it and what all the pieces are, and they've made that better. But then they've also made a lot of, the other big area where networking's improved was not so much from 2012 to 2012R2, but from 2008 to 2012, is the introduction of a scale-out file server. So we said at the beginning, you know, with the file server, the big change that was made was you can now run server workloads on a file server, and the file locking mechanisms allow that. In the past, if you were to, because you could technically do this, right? You could take Hyper-V and you could put a VM, VHD in a file share, and you could run it on 2008. But then half the time it had blue screen for no reason. And what happened is a packet got dropped.
Yeah.
Because storage paths, traditionally, if you look at storage paths like Fibre Channel or SATA or anything, you know, inside the case of the machine, 100% reliable. You're not going to get packet drop. You're not going to get a storage interruption because some guy went in the rack and jiggled the cable. So it's not resilient at all to the interruptions of day-to-day networking. And so when they built SMB 3.0, that's one of the components that was built in, was this idea that when you have server workloads, you could actually pause storage I/O and the VM wouldn't go, my hard drive's gone, and crash, right? Or SQL Server wouldn't go, the database is gone, and crash. And so a lot of the networking enhancements are really to enable those scenarios. And so you're going to see a focus on networking here, and then in the next section, which is storage, networking there as well, but networking specific to storage scenarios, and specifically the file server scenarios.
Primarily, we're talking about, the workload piece
on
the storage side of things that's coming up. And again, this is the potentially shorter section that we're going to be talking about. This one is specifically on optimized networking for Windows Server 2012. Now, you actually made a good point, and I'll come back to that in just a minute, about a lot of the changes on the networking side of things was to do for hosting environments, for large-scale environments and sort of stuff, and under the covers that's going on. So we'll get to that point specifically with software-defined networking and where that fits. Again, if you want to have access to stuff, we've seen this slide a couple of different times to be able to go off and download Windows Server 2012 R2 Preview at aka.ms/ws2012r2 and also System Center 2012 R2 with aka.ms/sc2012r2.
So for those of you that are going to do a download, my top tip, if you've not used a little tool called WIM2VHD, because should I download the VHD? Should I download the WIM file? Can I boot off the VHD? Download the ISO file. Windows 8, Windows Server 2012 both mount ISO files on the fly. So you just double-click it mounts it as a folder. You don't need another tool to do it. And you take the WIM.VHD install.WIM that's in there, and you download this PowerShell tool called WIM2VHD. And you say WIM2VHD, that WIM file, it produces a bootable VHD. So you can take that, you produce a VHD from, you can now build a VM off that VHD, you can do a boot to VHD entry, you can specify with the PowerShell tool the syntax, or sorry, the type VHD, VHDX, the underlying size, the default's 40 gig VHD file size, you can make it bigger, smaller. And if there's multiple SKUs inside the WIM file, it'll actually produce that as well. That's basically how I produce VHDs for building VMs environments off. I get the ISO file, WIM to VHD, and go.
You don't mount the ISO and then hit click, click, next, continue,
no.
Figure?
No. Stop doing that in the late 60s.
Nice. Perfect. So for networking, what we're going to be talking about from a standard perspective is looking at specifically the biggest gorilla in the room, which is software-defined networking, or SDN, and then how we implement it, what we're doing. It's not proprietary what we're doing. It's doing industry standards sort of stuff for being able to do software-defined networking. We'll then take a look about how to deliver services in a continuously available fashion, take a look at how to improve networking performance with offload or receive-side scaling and things like that, and then doing some simplified management with SCVMM and also IPAM, and then finally wrapping it up a little bit with networking in a hybrid environment as well for some stuff. But if you sprinkle this across all the different types of pieces of stuff that we'll be talking about in some way, shape, or form in 2012 R2 is basically Hyper-V network virtualization, the concept of, again, the extensible switch that's inside Hyper-V. We'll be talking about some from continuously available applications, DHCP failover, NIC teaming, quality of service. Yep. Some of these things we've already touched on already in other areas. And then, you know, going through a bunch of these other things in there as well. Good coverage.
It is. There's a lot of, like, if you look at this list in general, there's a lot of things on there that are very distinct sort of feature areas. The software-defined networking is all about the switch and Hyper-V network virtualization. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you as a day-to-day admin, is not something you'll generally touch a whole lot. Like only multi-tenant hosters, or the other big scenario is merger and acquisition type scenarios.
Merger and acquisitions of large organizations.
Are going to be, you know, real big consumers of network virtualization. And then you're going to do it through VMM where it doesn't
easier.
Look... It does, well, not only is it easier, it doesn't actually look like you're doing network virtualization. You're just creating objects in VMM.
Yeah.
And network virtualization is what VMM does to implement what you've requested it to do.
Right.
There's another set of technologies in there which have to do with hardware acceleration.
Yep.
And most of those are the same in 2012 as they are in R2, with the exception of we've now taken RSS, receive-side scaling, and moved that into VMs as well, virtual receive-side scaling. Now, we'll get to that a bit later on, and I've got a little video I'll play for you, which was a demo done at TechEd with a whole bunch of NICs and a whole bunch of CPUs to kind of show that in action.
Mm-hmm. Let's actually dive in a little bit here with software-defined networking and that whole section specifically on what it is. Architecturally, architecturally, before we get to architecture, simply the background from a networking perspective is that, you know, generally in the past, network virtualization has kind of lagged behind the levels of changes and exponential growth that we've been seeing in the virtualization market from both compute and storage side of things. It needed to catch up for the stuff you could do with it. And the idea is that potentially... administrators that are inside that particular networking environment end up working with a very large number of systems. They're just dealing with onboarding new different systems that happen to be up there. And then the physical side of things, you can end up where you're trying to do virtual stuff at the hypervisor layer and then at the host layer, but then you don't have the ability to go off and integrate seamlessly into the physical switching layer side of things. That's been resolved and that's been addressed the stuff that we're doing in
R2. If you look at data center operations in large data centers, networking is about the only thing that's still done with Excel.
Yeah, it's manual.
Because you're tracking VLANs, you're tracking ports, you're tracking what customers on what port. Mm-hmm. Even with our own operations, we're not virtualized at the network level, and we still have spreadsheets of what switch ports go to what server and little labels on them.
Yep.
And it's stupid. We shouldn't have to do that, because anytime you want to make a single little tiny change, you're scared to death.
You got to make sure everything else is all
because
connected.
Not only are you afraid you're going to make the change wrong, you're sitting there going, is my documentation right? And so you check it all over again. You just burn massive amounts of hours. What you want to be able to do is do this at a policy level. See, these are the rules, and let the software that powers the switches and all the various components implement all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as an industry, we're still not there yet, right? But we're making great strides, and we're getting there. And some of these technologies with network virtualization, we're going to show you something new which is part of the data center abstraction layer, which is OMI management of switches, which is again also part of that, where I can move servers around and as part of the orchestration process have VLANs be configured on physical switches you know, via policy and via software versus by administrators.
Yeah. I mean, you brought up a really good point. Configuration change of the network layer in most data centers is done on a manual basis. It's an automated, it's labor, it's not automated, it's an intensive process,
yep.
requires a lot of change control to make sure you don't mess stuff up. And even more so than that, it's different tools for different things.
Yeah.
How you manage your switches versus how you manage your machines versus how you manage the virtualization layer versus how you manage your storage potentially. So there's a lot of different components that have to be put into play with a lot of different skill sets to be able to get it done. I'm trying to simplify that. Go down that path. So really, what is software-defined networking? The idea behind software-defined networking allows you to dynamically manage the network by enabling policies that span physical and virtual networks to be able to make changes as required. It abstracts the workloads from the physical network as well, and it goes through and controls your data center flow of traffic. So basically, if there is a congestion area in one particular thing, you can take action to change the path that you would be using to get from point A to point B for a particular application inside the data center to be more efficient as needs dictate. That's the whole concept behind, or the goals behind, what we're trying to do with software-defined
networking. It's network configuration via policy as opposed to network configuration via hand.
Right. Now, from a main critical point that this is possible at the virtualization layer and then also tied into the physical layer is this concept of the extensible switch that we have. It's not a replaceable switch. It's an extensible one that basically you can go in as an administrator and then add in third-party solutions and tie into different third-party solutions that are going to be basically injected into the actual virtual switch inside the Hyper-V hosts. And then again, this in turn managed by System Center Virtual Machine Manager to keep it easy and keep track of where the different fabrics are.
Let's put this in perspective a little bit and talk about why it's necessary, right?
Okay.
So in large data centers, particularly today and going back in the past, the switching fabric, that layer 2 switching and the layer 3 routing fabric, mm-hmm. Typically is a very expensive solution that they will usually standardize on with one or more vendors, usually a very low number of vendors. And then those vendors, and you're talking about the high-end guys like Cisco, give you all the switches, and then they have management software that's very comprehensive that goes across all their switches.
Right.
So you have a single pane of glass, for example, for an entire data center's worth of Cisco fabric that you can then use to do software-defined networking, where you can put policies that are applied across all different switches, you can bubble everything up to one central console, and it's great. But that's a silo mm-hmm. that's separate from, for example, the hypervisors, that's separate from the storage. And as we begin to introduce virtualization, you now have fewer numbers of larger servers, and you've got this layer where you have the physical switch, and then you've got these layers of virtual switches inside the hypervisor. So how do we take those virtual switches, and this by the way, is one sort of scenario, it's mm-hmm. not the only one, to take those virtual switches and make them peers with the physical switches and gain the same level of management and insight. For example, how do I disable a switch port for a VM that's on a virtual switch? And that's where this notion of switch extensions comes into play. Because Cisco, for example, for the Nexus 1000 is the one that is been the most commonly discussed, is writes a switch extension provider that you can add to your Hyper-V servers, which allows their software to manage Hyper-V switches as if they were physical switches.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you define a policy for all the physical switches, that policy can now trickle into the virtual switches as well. And you can say, oh, server 15 needs to be throttled to 10 megabit per second. And server 15 happens to be VM, happens to be on a virtual switch named vSwitch1 on a Hyper-V server. It can do that through the switch extension.
Right.
Right, so that's one of the scenarios for the virtual switch and for the switch extensions. And they've gotten better, obviously, in R2, because the switch extensions in the past were part of the parent partition. Now switch extensions were not part of the switch, they were on the parent. Now they're part of the switch, so they see both customer address space and provider address space in a network virtualization mm-hmm. configuration. We'll get more to that a little bit later on, but
yep.
that's one of the big changes there. So that's, at a high level, what the idea behind switch extensions are. It's not something you're just going to go, oh, let's go turn this on and see if we get it. you're going to get this. There's going to be something you got to learn. There's going to be integration that's involved. So it's not a trivial thing.
Right. And it's also not the extensions of the Virtual Switch are not just made by Microsoft. They're made by a whole whack of different providers that do traditional hardware, that also do software-based only things. And so they basically are going to be doing capture-type extensions to be able to capture and look at and monitor traffic. They do filtering extensions to be able to filter off where different things should be going.
So your traditional, you know, switch port access control lists, ports, protocols, that kind of stuff.
And then obviously they do forwarding as well to be able to put stuff off in the different directions where that goes. Now, from an abstraction layer, what the nice little architecture discussed basically this concept is that it overlays over top of multiple virtual networks on a shared physical network, as you mentioned, from a hosting provider as an example, or your own data center. And it uses industry standard general routing encapsulation, or NVGRE encapsulation, to be able to move stuff between the physical and the virtual across the wire back up again to the virtual.
Network virtualization is a tricky concept. Mm-hmm. And I love going in. I wish I could in the room right now go, who thinks they understand this? Because I'm willing to bet that very few people would put their hand up and go, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Most people don't. So let me try and put this in perspective a little bit and give you a bit of an insight into what network virtualization is essentially designed to do by going back 10 years. Mm-hmm. So have a look at my screen for a second. Let's, you know, do one of those woo wavy kind of flashback deals, and we're all wearing disco gear. And,
nice.
You know, I want, you know, Rick in one of those flared checkerboard pants and a big fluffy yellow shirt, just doing a strut.
I still had the same hat, though.
You still had the same hat. By the way, yes, so back to my screen for a second, please. This is just because I love Rick. If you do want to get the inside scoop on many, many, many things...
You don't have it up there, do you? It's on a different tab in IE.
If you want to scoop on many, many things, this is who you need to follow on Twitter.
Nice.
If you want the scoop on lots of things and you know, the real story about what's going on and whatnot. So
now, to be completely honest, I have no idea who actually controls this
account. Which is what's so great about it.
So it is out there. But let's go back to the serious part. Virtual switches.
That is the series.
And where
all
we
right.
Are.
So if you go back 10 years, right, and you had two companies, right? You had company A over here, which is in red, and we had company B over here, which is in blue. Okay, and I have a client over here that needs to talk to a server over there. Let's do those in green.
He's doing this all. He's like finger painting right now.
I know. I feel like
he doesn't have a stylus.
So there's a client over here needs to talk to a server over here.
Okay, right? But there are two different customers.
And so these are two different
business units.
Two different companies, right? And so this guy's got a 10.x address, and this guy's got a 20.x address. Now, for those of you that are kind of get network virtualization, you go, wait a minute, just bear with me for a second, okay? This is a concept. And so you go, well, how do I get, and then up here in the middle, I've got the internet, the weeb, right? And so I've got a firewall here, and I've got a firewall here, okay? And so essentially, how this would have, works and still works today is on the outbound side, this is like a NAT device, mm-hmm. right? And so it translates the internal IP of this company to whatever their public IP happens to be over here. Mm-hmm. So this guy goes out, receives an address translation, routes across the internet, and over here on this side, we have publishing rules. This is a really awkward way of doing it. So we have publishing rules. So this firewall has a table of publishing rules that say, these ports go to open for business, and so it routes it in, and it receives a reverse translation on the way in. So it's TAN, it's reverse NAT.
Yeah, this is just standard internet traffic stuff that we're talking about right now.
Exactly,
right?
And so there's a database that controls all this, right? Which is DNS, right? And so if you take this concept right here. This is kind of what network virtualization does for Hyper-V when you have multiple tenants that need to exist but not be able to ever talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to replace a few components here. And let's the first thing we'll do is let's just say that both of these customers use the same internal address space, which is fine.
I've got some good build slides on this if you want.
No, I don't. Okay. I don't. I like this.
Okay.
So let's assume this guy over here for a second is I think your build slides will work a lot better. Is still, you know, in the same sort of subnet. So what we've got here is, you know, a customer, and let's say for example, for these are not two physical locations, but this is like server one here, and this is server two over here. That's the world's worst number one.
Yeah.
So let's assume that instead of being two companies, these are now two physical servers, right? And let's, instead of assuming that we've got DNS here and the web, let's get rid of the web and let's get rid of DNS, right? And let's get rid of this, and let's get rid of this here. And let's get rid of NAT and get rid of NAT. And let's say that these firewalls are basically the network virtualization software in Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. So this is the network virtualization component of Hyper-V, which is on for example, virtual switch. And let's say that that database component that tracks all these publishing rules, which are stored in the database, is basically VMM, right? And let's say that the internet
is no longer the public internet.
It's no longer the public internet, but is rather network. Your real, honest-to-God TCP/IP network, right? And instead of translating the addresses via NAT, all it's going to do is take this entire packet right here and put it out over the wire and encapsulate it using GRE, which, by the way, is the same protocol that PPTP uses.
Yeah. NVGRE.
It's generic routing encapsulation,
right.
Which is an industry standard way of saying, take this IP packet and make it the payload for another IP packet and put another header on it.
Yep.
Okay.
Now this is, if you go back to your whiteboard again so I can see it up there and still get the right terms, that stuff, the red network at the very top, is your own internal network.
This is the provider network.
The provider network. That provider network could be
anything.
Could be shared amongst those two companies. Could be isolated between those two companies.
Could be IPv4. Could be
IPv4, IPv6.
There could be routers in the middle here.
VLANs that are going on in there as well.
As long as this interface right here
can talk to the other.
Talk to this interface right here.
Right. And they have the appropriate rules on the physical side of things that allow them to talk to each other.
When server in virtual network, we'll call this virtual network A, over on server one, wants to talk to a server in virtual network B virtual network A over on server two.
Right.
VMM is able to track what is essentially a routing table within Hyper-V that says, here are the endpoints that exist on every other Hyper-V server for every single virtual network, and this becomes basically a routing table.
Yep.
And it's able to distribute that across all the Hyper-V hosts. So what they're able to then do is when I want to, you know, if this is, for example, 10.1, this is, you know, 10.0.0.1, this is 10.0.0.2, when the client 10.0.0.1 wants to talk to the server 10.0.0.2, it's able to go out through network virtualization, get dropped in an IP packet. Network virtualization through this routing table function knows which Hyper-V server contains that destination IP, ships it to that Hyper-V server, unpacks the GRE stuff, which gives you just the original IP packet as the payload, and sends it straight into the appropriate Hyper-V host.
Right. And the important part is, again, that abstraction of that provider network, how it gets from one to the other, the knowledge is in that particular database and that particular setup, and the different hosts know it. So they could even have if they were two separate things, they could even have the same network address ranges to be able to go off and talk to each other, or they could have completely different address ranges to be
because
able to go off and talk to each other.
Because if you look at the contents, I know you've got a couple of slides that do this.
Yeah.
But if you look at the contents of a GRE packet for network virtualization, on the top half of it, you have the provider IP.
Yep.
Then you have a subnet ID, right, which that's horrible, which is essentially the indicator of which virtual network that particular IP is on inside the VM. Then you have the real IP that the actual virtualized host sent.
Yep.
And so these two components right here are used to get it to the right Hyper-V host, onto the right network in that Hyper-V host, and then the real IP is sent into the actual VM. Now, and as far as the VMs are concerned, They're on the same subnet. They don't even know any of this happens. It's completely transparent.
So if we actually just take another little step back again, is to look at this from a different perspective. In the past, the way people would do this isolation inside large data centers, they'd use VLANs.
Right, right. So you'd have lots of switches.
Tons and tons of VLANs.
Right, and it became a scalability issue because you can only put so many network cards in a Hyper-V host.
And you can also only have so many VLANs on a network.
Right,
right.
There's 1,024 or something.
It's actually 4095. But really, most switches freak out at around 1,000 and change. So that's like a big problem of having this amount of isolation for the way that you handle very large scale data centers. Not so much for a company.
And I've also seen switches. I've actually had this happen. I've run into switches where if you have multiple VMs on different VLANs that have the same IP and the same MAC, because you can have that scenario. Yep. You do static MACs. The switches freak out because they've got the same MAC that's coming in two different ports and they don't know where to route it. I've seen scenarios where that's literally taken down parts of the network. So this gets rid of all of that.
Yep.
There's no VLANing. There's nothing. It's merely taking an IP packet, knowing it's a way of all the Hyper-V servers collectively knowing which subnets are on which servers and what IPs exist in those subnets through a table format, sharing it amongst themselves through VMM. You don't need VMM, but you can use PowerShell, but I wouldn't.
It's way easier with VMM.
You'd be typing a lot of commands.
Yeah.
And then there are mechanisms included for dynamic discovery, so that if you have DHCP-based clients, because the question often comes up, if I have a network on one Hyper-V host where a DHCP server is, a network on another Hyper-V host where the DHCP client is, how do they broadcast through network virtualization? And the answer is they can in R2 because it's smart enough to take that and know where the DHCP server is and just package that broadcast as unicast, ship it over, unpack it, and let the broadcast go inside.
Let's take a look at some of the architecture, just kind of breakdowns, a different version of visualization of what this looks like here. So in this case, again, the problems that this solves is it allows you to do complete and total VM mobility across anywhere inside the data center, your host or cloud, or even Azure without any networking constraints. It gives the ability to go and import in customer IP addresses and network topology, bring your own IP as we were talking about. You can go ahead and have multiple IP ranges that are overlapping in the same inside this environment because they are all encapsulated. It helps you remove your VLAN constraints and also helps eliminate the old hierarchical IP address issue that's out there. So literally, Blue Machines and Yellow Machine as two different companies would then be able to go off and live happily inside a blue network of ranges and a yellow network of ranges.
It's the idea of a subnet, a single flat subnet that can span multiple physical subnets and multiple physical hosts. Because the hosts, through these tables, know which machines having which IPs on which subnets are where and are able to just exchange the data packets back and forth.
So an example over here we've got with the Hyper-V network virtualization, the idea you can have multiple tenants with overlapping IP address range space on the same physical network and still have them talk to each other is the fact that you've got, where it is there, so here we've got an address range, you've got your host for Blue is up at 10.1.1.1 and 10.1.1.2 is as a SQL server and a web server, it's up there, what Blue sees. You then have your provider address space where the Hyper-V layer, the provider level space, is down below. It's on 192 network range. They have address of 1.10 and 2.12, so this is basically just routable between the two of them. They basically are able to go in and know the translation that the Hyper-V does. Hyper-V does the translation between which hosts those two individual boxes happen to be residing on. They maintain the tables for them. And then you've got a second company that gets brought in with the exact same IP address ranges that can also coexist on those guys, and it simply keeps track of who is where and what and shared through.
And like the key to take a look at up there is in the two tables with the two little graphics, the blue and the orange, and there's a little table below there showing how the virtual IPs map to the physical IPs.
Right.
There's one component that's missing from that table, which is the subnet ID.
Right. Well, that comes up in the next slide, which actually shows you the packet going through, like you did with your lovely whiteboard diagram.
Excellent.
That's out there. So this is the whole packet flow concept, right? So you've got a machine called Blue 1 wanting to talk to a machine called Blue 2. It's on two different networks, as you can see there, and you've got the Hyper-V switch that's in there. You've got network blue virtualization packet flow between these two guys that you want to go off. So the first one basically is standard IP address stuff. The machine says, hey, I'm trying to get to 10.11. Do you know where 10.11 is? It's going to go off and do an ARP packet to go off and try to locate that guy. What's going to happen is basically the Hyper-V switch is the one that goes in and is using a provider ID for the Hyper-V switch. that is shared between those two different systems, the VSID of 5001 between Hyper-V1 and Hyper-V2. They're both there. It's going to go off and broadcast that on that guy there. Hyper-V switch will broadcast the ARP to the rest of the network, but it's going to be intercepted by the filter because it knows where the other guy happens to be. The NV filter goes in and checks the policy table. You mentioned what the policy table was and where it sits. Basically, it knows that 10.11 has this particular MAC address that is on the other side that's out there. The NV filter basically goes and sends the response as if it came back from that original client, but it actually came from the switch, transparent to the guest.
Yeah,
and like to basically say, hey, it's over there on blue.
The key thing here is that if the ARP broadcast is for a MAC address that's on another physical host, the switch intercepts, knows that, and responds that, basically saying, I know where that is, here's the MAC key.
Yeah.
And then continuing down the path, you got blue is going to go off and construct its packet. That it needs to go off and talk to blue number two, sends it off to the Hyper-V switch down the regular stack as it would. Hyper-V2 switch goes in and attaches on its VSID.
That's the virtual subnet ID.
It then goes down and then checks to see if it's allowed to contact the other guy. Again, this is from a security perspective. It can get over there. It then goes in and uses NVGRE encapsulation, as you mentioned, to route it across the physical of the provider space through all the appropriate different mechanisms that are at the provider space level, and then back up into Hyper-V box that is at controlling where Blue 2 happens to reside. It comes up. It then goes and gets removed and then brought up the stack, as you saw before. It gets stripped down, the virtual switch subnet gets removed, and then it goes back to your regular packet to that guy.
Yeah, keep in mind, the three things that are basically involved here, aside from, you know, MAC and all that kind of stuff, is IP, subnet, host.
Right. It's the same stuff you would expect to find, IP, subnet, and host, as if they were just two machines using regular IP on a same physical piece of wire talking to each other. Now we've got the virtualization layer that goes in, and there has to be some layer of accountability and knowledge of the underlying network to get between those two.
Absolutely. So.
And again, simplified, done, easier using SCVMM to be able to talk to all those different pieces that are in there.
And so, like, if you want to just real quick jump in SCVMM for a second, I'll show you a couple of quick things. Again, we're not going to go deep into this, but...
Jump over to his system for a second?
Yeah, just have a look right down here in the desktop, guys. So in VMM, you've got this concept of a VM network, right? And a VM network... is a virtual network. And so within a VM network, you can create things like IP pools and subnet. Look at the properties of it. VM subnets that are associated with this network, because you can have more than one subnet within a virtual machine network. And then within that, within the subnets, you can actually also create IP pools, which it's a VMM concept for, like, you know, VMM's version of DHCP for dynamically assigning static addresses. Again, if you're not familiar with VMM, this isn't really the time to kind of go... You know, we're not really teaching VMM right now, but just kind of pointing out where these things exist. So you've got this notion of, a VM network that you can create. Then when you create virtual machines, if I look at my actual VMs here, when you look at virtual machines, you can actually take individual VMs, and then when they're created in the configuration of the VM, and that's, I don't know why that's grayed out right now, it should be available. You can choose the logical switches and also the virtual networks that they're allowed to be connected to and the subnets that they're on.
Right.
And then Hyper-V takes care of everything else for you. So you're no longer just, when you create a VM, specifying, you know, here's the virtual NIC and here's the switch it's plugged into. Now you've got this whole other layer of
fabric.
The whole other layer of fabric, which is what virtual network are you on? And then which hosts support that virtual network. And then network virtualization will take care of moving things back and forth. So it's a whole new set of configurations that are available when you build VMs that are only, none of this, by the way, is exposed by the Hyper-V UI. This is all exposed by only Virtual Machine Manager or by PowerShell on Hyper-V. And I believe we have a poll that just went up, Rick.
Yeah, a little while ago. The poll is up, and in case you're interested, there is a question that's up in the corner. If you are switched over to a full screen video mode, switch back into a windowed mode to be able to see the poll if you're interested. Basically, we're looking to find out, has your opinion of Windows Microsoft's approach to Server 2012 R2 changed? Yay or nay? Go off and answer the poll. Nice little data point for us to know what's going on and how you're liking it. with software-defined networking, there's also another piece that we have involved, which is how you manage it, as you mentioned earlier, with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. It's in there. We also have the ability to go through and basically not just have connections to your local physical environment and local physical switches that are out there. You have the ability to go off and connect to site-to-site gateways, site-to-site VPN connections, and other basic extensions of your network off to different providers.
Like all we've kind of mentioned here is how do I get VMA on host A to talk to VMB on host B on the same virtual network. Well, that's all fine and good, but I can almost virtually guarantee you they'll need to talk something in the real world too.
Yep.
So how do you get from network virtualization to physical network? And the answer is you need something called a network virtualization gateway.
Right.
And with 2012, the network virtualization gateways were only provided by hardware providers.
Right.
Now there's one built into Windows Server. The routing remote access component supports network virtualization gateway.
Mm-hmm.
So you create a machine on your virtual network that acts as the ingress and egress points to get you from virtual to physical and back again.
Right. And that guy can also be scalable as well if you need to. They'd be able to have resiliency, can have connections in an isolated fashion to multiple sites, not just to one site, obviously, and works both between the virtual network and the physical network for what happens to SID. So that part there is included with 2012 R2 from a server perspective. Now, you mentioned, again, the whole concept of talking to the physical layer switches as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we have to get into network switch management. Now, this was something that was introduced as a concept and available in 2012, but it's been refined in 2012 R2 with what's known as OMI for the Open Management Infrastructure capabilities, where basically there are third-party switches, physical hardware switch manufacturers, that are implementing OMI models inside their switches that can then be queried and accessed and managed by PowerShell, as an example, as one particular tool, even though they're not running Windows of any kind inside that switch whatsoever.
Well, I mean, the great thing about PowerShell is PowerShell heavily leverages WMI. WMI is Windows, let me start that over again. WMI is based on WinRM, which is Windows Remote Management, which is based on essentially HTTP, typically, based management of remote systems. And, you know, there was a working group that got together back in the late 90s, a whole bunch of big software companies, and they essentially said, hey, we need a way to be able to standardize management of all different types of, you know, at the time was operating systems. And that's where this whole notion of, you know, of WinRM and sort of WMI came from, and WinRM is Microsoft's implementation of that, of something that was originally called WebM, Web-Based Enterprise Management.
Yeah.
And so WebM evolved to, WMI evolved to WinRM as a protocol. But that whole standard is what everything in Windows for Management is built around. Everything in Windows for Management is built around PowerShell. PowerShell leverages WMI. WMI leverages WinRM as the protocol, which is based on these WebM centralized standards. Now what we're seeing is hardware providers beginning to embrace those standards at the very lowest levels, such as through IPMI, which is essentially baseboard management protocols for servers. So things like your Dell iDRAX, your HP ILOs are similar in concept. IPMI and SMASH are protocols that can be used to do that. And for example, Dell iDRAC and HP ILO, they both support those protocols. So you don't have to necessarily use their tools. You could use a third-party tool to do, you know, remote power on, remote power off, diagnostics consoles, that kind of stuff. But you can now also do it for certain switches. And so what I've got here is a little sort of a simulation thing to show you. We don't have a supported switch to work with. But I've got a couple of samples that the teams that do this provided me to show everybody about just kind of what this sort of looks like. And this is all done in PowerShell. And this is scary PowerShell. This isn't the friendly Git process PowerShell. This is the scary PowerShell.
Yeah.
So don't be intimidated by the complexity of the PowerShell code that you're seeing here. This is more to illustrate just the raw point that this is possible. And so you can kind of see what it looks like. Where you as an administrator would see this manifested, you know, as something you go work with is through administration tools.
Yep.
If you're right now watching this and you're saying, my company builds those administration tools, well, then this is what you'd be most interested in. For most of us, you know, we're going to get, you know, we're going to use Virtual Machine Manager. We're going to say provision a switch. And Virtual Machine Manager is going to do all this stuff under the hood.
You catalog what switches you have, if they support it or not.
It's going to do all this. We're not. But if you're building those kinds of tools, well, then this is kind of what it looks like. So what we've got is a basically a little simulated switch running in a little Linux VM.
Nice.
And so what I've got here is essentially a logon process that we're going to
And you're actually simulating an Arista switch, I see.
Yeah, it's
here.
An Arista switch. So we're just going to log on to it. It takes just a second for it to authenticate. And so then we can actually see what it is. So this is information on the firmware of the switch.
So you're just interrogating the switch for details.
Right. And so I just kind of bring this up a little bit. So we can see, you know, just some basic stuff. Now this is a little similar. It doesn't actually give me a whole lot of data back, but you can see a few little things, right? So this is some firmware information on the switch itself. So as an example, if the switch supports those standards, through PowerShell you can do things with it. And if you know, if you have five different manufacturers, as long as they all support the standard, you don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of just setting a banner on a switch. So you can actually, you know, when you first would log on via what would typically be, you know, Telnet or
yeah.
console,
yep.
You know, you get a, hey, welcome to the banner, right? This is, or welcome to the switch. This is an example of setting a property. So one of those properties, banner, and just setting it to a string value.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got some information on what we can do with ports. Right, so here's enabling and disabling a port. Actually, before I do that, Ethernet port. Okay, so yeah, so here we go. So this is an example of one port in the switch. There's a lot of information shown here, but this is everything we know about one specific port. When it was set up, some of these are, you know, sort of generic properties that
yeah.
get inherited from the greater switch configuration, but you've got things down here like max speed, requested speed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in some data center scenarios, you might have certain switch ports you limit to 10 gig or 100 gig or 10 meg, 100 meg, or a gig.
I was saying, I've heard of 100 gig yet.
Well, they're not far away. And then you can enable or disable a switch. Like, and this is just using
different ports on the switch.
Different states, right? State 2, state 3, which would enable or disable the port on the switch.
I see what you mean by the unfriendly PowerShell side of things. This is not stuff you'd be typing on a regular basis.
It gets
this
better.
Is part of your management tools.
Yeah.
Say, oh, turn on a switch
it gets
port,
better,
turn
yeah.
off a switch port.
Yeah, this is
that's the easy stuff still?
Yeah.
Great.
But like this little sample right here creates a couple of VLANs on the switch.
Oh, yeah?
And so if we do, where am I to? Input method. This we got right here. So grab that one. So these are the VLANs that are
three
available.
Three different VLANs that you created.
Right?
Yep.
So, you know, and I'm not going to go through every little tiny bit down here, but there's samples in this on setting trunk access, for example. So trunking two ports on a switch.
Yeah.
Which, depending if you're doing network keeming, you may do trunking with the switch.
Where are these? Are these people can access these or not?
No.
These are private ones?
This is best to leave that alone. Right?
Okay. Leave that alone.
This isn't public now. That being said, there will be a public version of this.
Yes.
This is it's a hosted lab that was at TechEd.
Oh, okay.
That was only at TechEd. It didn't go into the virtual lab scenario. I've still got access to it because we're still hosting it.
Yeah.
But there's a version of this that's under dev that's going to be released to the public in a couple of weeks. So
eventually.
Eventually you will
you
get
can
to see.
Toy around with the ability to go off and to manipulate a virtual switch that's simulating an Arista switch.
And then so tomorrow I've got another one here which is doing similar things but with IPMI to a baseboard.
Yep.
So like remote booting servers through PowerShell.
Nice.
So we'll get to that tomorrow.
Now, I called out the name of the Arista switch as one example, but there's basically a whole bunch of different types of software-defined networking partners that are working with us to be able to work in this whole software-defined networking.
What I was
space.
Told is they're the only ones that had an emulator like that.
In this case, we've got some gateway appliances that are available from F5, from Iron Networks and other ones. We've got, obviously, the Arista switch, which is OMI-based network. switching capabilities. You got a whole whack of different types of extensions. The typical one you'd expect to see is the NEC, is the Cisco one that's out there. You have control Cisco switches, the NEC, Five9 software for doing some filtering and different sort of things like that, and then InMon for monitoring that sort of stuff, and then also chipset extensions as well to be able to bake inside the switch. So a whole whack of stuff for people that are working in the SDN space that we're all working and playing well
and
with
so just,
to be able to do this sort of
so
stuff.
One more little thing that I'm just going to show.
Sure.
Jump back in on my screen for a sec. Again, this is within, you know, I mentioned, you know, you would never do all of this stuff. And you mentioned, like, in those little slide of partners, the top of rack switch partners.
Yep.
Within your fabric for virtual machine manager, you can actually come down here under service providers. Network service providers. And if you add new services in, some of the things that you can add include things like top of rack switches.
Right.
So you put a name in there. I don't have one, so I can't complete this entirely. And so, for example, this is a Windows standards-based network switch, which would be a switch that supports OMI.
Right.
You're credentialed to actually use the switch, and then whatever the connection string you actually need is with an IP and a port, whether it's something else, whatever the case might be. And away you go.
Right? Okay, so you're cataloging your resources in your fabric within your data center inside a CVMM. You're putting in the connection mechanisms into interfacing with the physical. You already know what the virtual is, and then you're basically able to go off and manipulate the stuff and configure the things back and forth so that a regular administrator that's working in this environment doesn't need to know all this background stuff of what's going on, and it's all also entirely automated.
And, you know, I'm allowed to share opinions on some things, probably a little more freedom than you are. Personally, I don't look at this as virtual machine manager. I look at this as data center hardware manager.
Yeah.
Because it can literally manage all the hardware, the storage, the networking, switching, load balancers, Hyper-V hosts, VMware hosts, Citrix Xen hosts. So it's a fabric manager far more than it is a virtual machine manager.
Right. And so, now, I am going to call it once again, channelline.msdn.com/event/TechEd, because there's been a number of different sessions on there about software-defined networking, about different levels of integration sort of stuff. Go off and take a look at them.
Yeah, some of them actually brought in the guys from some of the hardware providers when, hey, show, you know, demos what you guys can actually do.
Right. I'm just going to wrap up this whole SDN piece and put this one to bed with this one last slide that simply just shows off a whole bunch of different advantages and benefits to different owners. The workload owner basically is able to go off and migrate workloads across different clouds, across different providers. You don't have to worry about where the different physical stuff happens to reside. As far as enterprises are concerned, it reduces your operational costs because you're getting out of the manual and into the automated and out of the automated documentation and sort of stuff. Simplifies consolidations and mergers. Hoster environments obviously allows your customers to worry about their own stack and their own infrastructure to bring into your environment as a hosting environment. You don't have to ask them, oh, can you mind rechanging your IP address of your box to make it work? Which is basically a death wish. Do you mind if we take your 10 servers and change them from the IP address that they've been using for the last 3 years and change them to this range? From that perspective, and obviously an extension from the private to public cloud data center, because all the stuff we've been talking about here, we've been talking about inside one provider network, that could be your own internal private cloud that then is going to go off with site-to-site up to an Azure environment or a hoster's environment as well.
Well, you see scenarios where, you know, merger and acquisitions, big company by small company. Small company has a bunch of servers that are running in VMs, which big company doesn't want to reconfigure. They want to just drop in their data center and get them out of small companies, you know, rickety old office and onto big companies, you know, big cool slick data center. And rather than reconfigure everything, they drop it in a virtual network with a gateway. So, you know, small companies' clients can still talk to small companies' servers while they run on big companies' hardware.
You got it.
I think.
You got it. So let's move off of this one here and into network solutions, basically this whole part of continuous availability. This is where some of the new functionality comes into the hardware settings and sides of things. So network fault tolerance with SMB multi-channel, being able to go off and to handle doing file copies from one location to another location with multiple paths and multiple sessions connected up from the client to the server, whatever that happens to be. Be able to go through doing bandwidth aggregation through teaming, multiple nodes in CPU for network processing because you're using receive-side scaling across the different systems. The idea behind this is that you've got basically traffic that's going through multiple paths to get over to, for instance, a simple thing like a file copy. And then all of a sudden you happen to have a path that goes down. It's able to go through and basically continue on working and then reroute the information through whatever path it needs to get to that environment. So basically, it heals itself.
You want to see it?
Where it goes. So you gotta. Is this a video? Or is this a demo?
No, that's a demo. I can show you this.
Okay, go ahead.
Have a look over. So I've got a. This is a very simple little setup. This, by the way, is one of the public Windows Server 2012 virtual labs.
Yep.
But it's all ready to go. So I just use this. So what I've got here is three servers. Okay. Let's point out what they are. I've got a SQL server. SQL server's got three network cards in it. Okay. All three network cards, importantly, are on three logical subnets. Mm-hmm. So there's a 10 dot, a 11 dot, and a 192 dot. I believe 192, and yep. 11 and 12.
And 11 and 12. Okay.
And this is important because SMB multi-channel requires different socket endpoints. Mm-hmm. That's what it needs. And so what we can actually do is we start a workload here. And this workload, by the way, it's using the tool called SQLIO, which we're going to use a couple of times throughout the course of this to show different scenarios. We'll use it in particular when we do the storage tiering. But essentially, it basically does read and write to a file, and it's designed to simulate a high load SQL Server database. So we run that, and it's going to run a bunch of assorted types of file copies. And they all go to, if you notice, a little share called SQL data, SQL 1 database, testfile.dat, which resides on a highly available file server, mm-hmm. which is fronted by node 1 and node 2. And you can see that it actually generates traffic across all three network cards at the same time. Right? So you can see all three of them, and they're all roughly the same. If I go over on node 1 and node 2, you can see that. Here we go. So that node 2 is receiving inbound traffic. And one of these, by the way, is the iSCSI SAN. So mm-hmm. you're seeing it coming in on 3. The 10 is the iSCSI SAN. And then going back to storage on the iSCSI SAN. And so you'll typically see the iSCSI SAN is going to be a little bit more than the rest of them because it's got to aggregate all the traffic.
Aggregate them all in.
Now, the math doesn't add up directly, and I don't know why that is, but it just doesn't. And you'll notice that the other guy is... is not receiving any traffic. Okay. Now I can't demo this for you in 2008 or 2012 R2. I wish I could, but I couldn't get this working. To be quite honest with you, mm-hmm. With 2012 R2, it can actually go to both nodes at the same time.
Right.
So right now the multipath is only going to one node. If I had another client running, that client could actually go to the second node. So this is essentially what multipath is. And if I go ahead and look at let me go grab a little PowerShell command I've got here. So if I go look at SMB cluster, where's my multipath? Multichannel, there we go. I'm just going to open this little bit of PowerShell here. Let me grab the PowerShell ISE. And I'm going to grab this guy right here. Run him in PowerShell ISE. A little bit easier to read.
Nice.
And I want to just make sure that workload's running in the background. Let me kill it, start it again so that it's running. So I know it's running. And all right, so what I'm going to do is just run this command right here. And so what you'll see on the computer SQL, which is the source for all of this, is all the different established SMB connections.
Mm-hmm.
So all the available paths are being used by the node to make sure that it can route basically traffic multiple different ways, right? And so this is the equivalent.
If any of those paths goes down, it's able to still continue.
Right. If any one path goes down, it doesn't care. It just continues on the rest of it.
Right.
This is what in the SAN world is the equivalent of MPIO.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no DSMs required. We'll talk about this more in stories. And there's no DSM module configuration required. There's no reboots required. It just works.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you bring online, the more paths it will actually use.
Yep.
So this is SMB multipath, which, there in 2012, this is one of the massive, massive improvements from SMB 3.0 that's gotten better in 2012 because it can now go to both nodes at the same time, not just one node per endpoint. 2012 R2, yes.
There's so many numbers at the word.
I know.
Well, you know what? We'll switch gears a bit away from this and actually talk about something that's a bit more concrete, and this is DHCP.
Okay.
DHCP, highly available services now, as opposed to having to worry about clustering these guys. You now basically, this came out in 2012, that allows inbox support for failover without the need for clustering between those two different systems, as well as the ability to set it up for load sharing as well. And it's simply a matter of having two DHCP servers running 2012 or 2012 R2 that allows you then to go in and configure on a per scope basis, is this a failover relationship between the two of them, or is this a load sharing between the two of them? And it's able to go off and handle that one scope. Do you have a demo you want to show with that one?
It's not ready at this very second, but okay. I forgot to start
it. It's all right. It definitely exists and it definitely is there. The main thing is because it's the difference with R2, is they can, there's basically no difference. It's the same as R12, 2012, same as 2012 R2.
Well, the big change for R2, to be quite honest, is IPAM can now manage DHCP failover.
Right. But that's on the IPAM side. That's not on the DHCP side of things.
Right.
This example here, where we got the hot standby, there it is. Predictable QoS performance allows you to go through and basically understand the predictable performance you're going to have between sharing of access between two different servers. You can actually view the bandwidth used by individual services that are out there for virtualization, for virtual machines, for storage, for live migration, and you can basically put in some reservations that are in there for QoS. This is built into 2012 R2 preview. It is also available on hardware capable systems as well.
Yeah,
and it supports it
with Hyper-V as well. Don't forget, you've also got Hyper-V quality of service on the network.
Right.
So you can, with a Hyper-V VM, just like we did with IOPS this morning for disk, you do the exact same thing with networking that was introduced in 2012. Mm-hmm. It's gotten a little bit more robust, like everything with R2. But fundamentally, it's the same basic feature. You'd use it the same way. You set it through PowerShell, you set it through the GUI.
Right.
And you can limit or provide a minimum guaranteed bandwidth for any given VM, any given network card on the VM, which again solves that problem of one tenant consuming all the network bandwidth.
Mm-hmm. We already talked about NIC teaming. NIC teaming was there with 2012, the ability to go through and to have throughput on the different types of systems, up to 32 different network adapters, aggregating bandwidth for multiple network adapters. It includes multiple nodes with switch-dependent and also switch-independent environments. The thing that is different with this, again, it protects you from a failure. You can go off and take a look at it, and then the traffic simply redirects and continues, is that they now have, with 2012 R2, dynamic NIC teaming to be able to go in and basically, instead of all the traffic going through and out, mostly just on the one, it's able to go in and segment the flow of traffic that's going through into basically groups of packets across different NIC interfaces if they need to be able to have better throughput that's going through.
Yep.
So that part there is basically now available 2012 R2. Dynamic LBFO is what they're talking about here.
Now, if you've never done NIC teaming in 2012, have a look here for a second. Let me show you how easy this actually is. I'm not going to actually make the team per se.
Yeah.
But what I've got here is essentially a 3 NIC server. And to create a team, you simply go tasks, new team.
Mm-hmm.
Give it a name. I like always naming them this.
The A team. Nice.
And choose the NICs I want to be involved in the team, and then some additional properties. And so what's new down here is you have a load balancing mode, which is dynamic,
mm-hmm.
Which essentially is the best of both worlds over address hash or Hyper-V port, and is able to combine both of them to determine what the best flow rate is and get you better throughput. End of the day, unless you have a specific reason to choose address hash or Hyper-V port, you typically would choose dynamic. That's the default. And it'll figure out the fastest way to route stuff over the team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the teaming mode is where a lot of people are kind of confused, right? And if you just kind of go back to the basics of teaming, there's a couple of ways you do teaming. There's teaming that involves you and the switch, and there's teaming that involves no switch, and there's teaming that involves failover, and there's teaming that involves link aggregation. So the best type of teaming is when the network card and the switch cooperate and create a trunk,
right?
That's an example of where, if you look at software-defined networking, and you want to leverage OMI plus things like network teaming via PowerShell, you can now, through Windows Standard Management tools, go out and create a trunk that includes both the switch and the network card. You could never do that before. Run one PowerShell command and create a trunk, which trunks two ports on the switch, two ports on the server, and now you've got, instead of a 1 gig, a 2 gig, or instead of a 10 gig, a 20 gig, or instead of a 56 gig, a 112 gig.
Nice.
If you're using some of the Mellanox, the newer like InfiniBand stuff.
Yeah.
You can also do what's called static teaming. With static teaming, it ensures that you it's only one of the adapters at any one point in time is active, and it'll actually fail over to another one. Mm-hmm. And so again, the language, the nomenclature varies from vendor to vendor. This is what it is within Windows, but it's literally this easy to do. I click OK and I got a team. And then within PowerShell, NetLBFO, okay, there we go. These NetLBFO commands are how you create teams via PowerShell. Mm-hmm. So you can run one PowerShell command across all your servers and create teams. The warning I will give you, and the reason I didn't create the team here, is because I'm on an RDP session into the server. Now, granted, the server's all DHCP, so what's going to happen is it's going to create a team. Team's going to have a new MAC address.
It's going to request
to get a new address. So instead of one of the two IP addresses I'm currently connected on, I need to disconnect and reconnect using the new address, which means I have to flush my DNS cache. So creating a team which would switch the address around has that little bit of a negative impact of it does impact, you know, if the server's been operational a long time, it does actually impact DNS entries in the sense that the caches might be a little out of date, and so you may have clients that can't connect to it right after you make the team because they just need to flush their DNS cache to move on. So it's something you would typically do early in the build and deployment process of,
right.
Of the server. And there's one other point I was going to make, but it escapes. Another question that quite often comes up is, well, in these scenarios where I have a scale-out file server, right, and I've got multiple network cards in a file server, am I better off making a team or not making a team? You're better off actually not making a team in those scenarios, because scale-out file servers will leverage multipath, and if you have a team, that's only one path,
right?
Because the VNet, it's not going to be able to do as much bandwidth on a team because the team is one endpoint, the team's one IP address. So if I were to team this interface, I wouldn't get three network cards worth of ingress traffic. I'd get one network card's worth of ingress traffic because it's one endpoint. Mm-hmm. Whereas with three non-teamed adapters, I get three times the potential throughput. If one of those adapters goes down because it's a scale-out file server, because it leverages SMB multipath, it just goes, okay, and moves on and continues on. It continues working. So there you go.
Based on the role the server's doing, you may or may not want to enable teaming for the purpose of getting faster bandwidth as opposed
resiliency. Or resiliency, right? In the case of a scale-out file server, if it's a scale-out file server, you don't gain resiliency or bandwidth by teaming. Mm-hmm. You get that through SMB multipath.
Right.
Where I'd look at teaming is like my domain controllers, my application servers. That's where I'd be teaming stuff. I wouldn't be doing it on scale-out file servers.
Okay. We've got four pieces of real quick stuff that I just wanted to talk about, which deals with high-performance networking. So basically, this is all hardware-dependent stuff.
Yep.
We're talking about virtual receive-side scaling, SRIOV, dynamic VMQ, and SMB Direct stuff. We don't have anything to show with these, potentially, except maybe a video.
Yeah, I've got a little video here, which was about 3 minutes long. We'll play when you're ready.
Okay.
That shows a demo of some of these options.
But being conscious of time.
Okay.
Improved performance now supported also is SMB Direct with RDMA, the ability to go through and basically get offloading of network I/O processing to the network adapter as opposed to having to be CPU constrained on the different systems for the way that it works is basically supported. It's there. It's compatible with SMB multi-channel for load balancing and also for failover between the two different systems. That's there. We then also have dynamic virtual machine queue or dynamic VMQ now available on the systems, where basically you would have on a typical Hyper-V host without VMQ, you would have the issue of the virtual switch going through and talking to one CPU to be able to go off and to do all the processing that they have to have for the queue for what's going on. Now, with VMQ that's now available, you're able to go through and to balance that across the different systems, the different CPU cores, to be able to get better processing and less of a constraint. You also now have the ability to have dynamic VMQ, which will go through and, based on the load, move things around amongst the different cores as they become required or available for different resources, different things. So if a VM happens to be taxing one of those cores, it'll actually move the workload off and over to a different one and back on again. So dynamic VM queues available with 2012 R2 for where it sits. Virtual RSS, I think, is the one that you have a little bit of a demo to show quickly on, where you basically have a near line rate of a virtual machine talking to existing hardware to give you the receive side scaling functionality built into 2012 is now going to be able to be exposed to the virtual world. And the idea basically of having incoming packets going through without RSS, going strictly into node number one. Instead, you're now able to have it come in and go with RSS across the different loads, across the different nodes as required. Now, this is now able to be exposed into the virtual environment without virtual RSS scaling from a virtual machine perspective. It would, again, have contention just on the one, but then it is now able to have it spread across all four of them with virtual RSS capable systems. Now, do you want to show that? Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a little video here we'll play for you. So if you guys can hit the sound on this guy. And being completely transparent, this is a demo the guys did at TechEd. They had some pretty high-end hardware for it.
Right.
We couldn't show this, but I want to show you anyway, so we just snipped out the three-minute cool bit. So we'll go ahead and play that and see what you think.
What I'm going to do for you today is the LBFO, the NIC taming demo. We added a new mode called dynamic mode. But first, I want to show you what it looked like when in Windows Server 2012. So this graph on the right is performance monitor. You're going to see that we have the receive traffic. There's going to be we have four NICs on this machine, and the receive traffic will be on the left-hand side, and the send traffic will be on the right-hand side. The NIC teaming properties are here, and you see I have address hash selected. We get a good spread outgoing, but incoming is all on one NIC. So we also had Hyper-V port mode. So happens that we have three VMs on this host. You see that now we have this nice spread among three NICs, but we still have another NIC available that just isn't being utilized. So what we did with dynamic is we now break it into flowlets. So the outgoing traffic is now spread among all four NICs, even though there's only three VMs. So continuing with the performance, I'm going to show VRSS. So before, to a VM, you would see that, well, let me first take a step back. What we have here are two hosts. We have two computers connected back-to-back with 10 gig NICs. We have the sender here on the right and the receiver on the left with the VM here. I'm using an application called NTTCP that basically simulates workload traffic and creates multiple TCP connections. So in Windows Server 2012, the traffic coming in, let me just make sure the traffic starts. There we go. So the traffic coming into the VM was bottlenecked on one processor. You would see throughput of roughly 5.4 gigs. But we have 10 gig NICs, and we can't fully utilize them. Furthermore, we saw in the host, we were still affinitized to just one processor. So what we wanted to do is be able to use all the resources within the host without having to put new expensive hardware in there. So we did a lot of work advancing the VMQ algorithm and enabling RSS inside of the VM. And it's really just as easy as enabling RSS. So we'll go ahead and run the same test. We'll start the receiver and then the sender. And you'll see that just like in a physical host, the traffic is now spread among all cores. And our throughput is also jumping up above the 5 gigs. Not to mention, in the host, we expand on the dynamic VMQ capabilities, so if a core starts to become pegged or overutilized, we start moving those flows off of that core and onto available cores for processing.
Okay.
That was the weirdest experience trying to play a video.
For the record, we couldn't hear it.
We couldn't hear a damn thing, so apparently just, you guys all heard it. Yeah, so
it was just dead silent here. Just, I feel really bizarre right now. So that's essentially receive side scaling using some high-end hardware, and you can see that the VM cores don't get pegged. It's able to distribute it better across the different VMs. So what we got left, Rick? So I've got one geeky thing when you're ready.
Okay, I'm just going to go and first of all talk about this whole concept of manageability that we have. I'm not going to go into detail with every single one of these because we've basically covered them in some way, shape, or form that's out there. Switch this live just one second here. From a networking perspective, the idea of having the ability to go off and provide an easy-to-use automation, manage IP address space, simplify management in multi-site environments, and also monitor their use. The tools that are there in Box are IP address management. You can do resource metering at the VM level and also at the physical host level as well. You can do extensive monitoring with operations manager.
Just a little thing, right?
Just a little thing, tiny,
insignificant, simple executable install, no big deal.
And obviously, as you mentioned, you're managing your fabric, your networking fabric, with SCVMM for Virtual Machine Manager, and then obviously a whole bunch of Windows PowerShell sort of stuff as well.
Is IPAM being integrated with VMM or not?
I think it's still separate. It's a separate thing.
Okay.
A separate install. It's a feature you have to install on your server environment. It's a configuration process. It's all out there.
I thought I bumped across something somewhere about that.
There is one thing that I will draw out on this relative that is new with 2012 R2 is this concept of remote live monitoring, specifically at the virtualization layer. Don't need to show this, but I just want to call it out. The fact that you are able to go through and basically use a utility called the Microsoft Message Analyzer to go through and think of it like a network capture tool for the host looking at the VMs that are running inside the environment to be able to go off. It's near real time to be able to go off and to basically see the type of traffic's going on and being able to monitor, diagnose it, and fix it.
Yeah, it's one of the scenario for this is basically, right, some customer goes, hey, something's gone wrong. I've got, I'm getting attacked. I don't know what's going on in my network. And the only way you could monitor it was to go in the customer's VM and do it there.
Into all of them on the host to see what's going on. Right.
This allows you to monitor at the host level all traffic inbound and outbound from a VM.
Right.
And it supports virtual networks as well as customer address-based networks as well as provider address-based networks.
Networking in a hybrid cloud environment is the next little piece here. Again, simply a matter of, we talked about this whole virtualization aspect of the software-defined network and where the virtualization of the network and that sort of stuff. The fact that we now have in-box a multi-site-to-site RRAS solution to give you the ability to have virtual integration to the different physical worlds that are out there. So therefore, that gives you cross-premise connectivity. It gives you the ability to extend your private cloud to Azure or your private cloud to individual hosters, in a secure fashion that's out there. So that is in-box and available within Server 2012 R2. And with that, I'll leave you to your geeky thing that you wanted to share. Of course, I caught you completely off guard, didn't I?
You sure did.
I dropped you fast. No segue or transition.
The best tool ever invented is ping.
Mm-hmm.
And ping is ping, and everybody knows ping, and you can all ping, and I ping, and you ping, and we all ping, and everybody pings, right?
I'm a fan of dig.
You're a fan of dig? Fair enough. I'm a fan of ping. You ping something, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's a new one now.
Yeah?
And it's better. So there's a new ping. It's a commandlet called test
PowerShell commandlet
net connection.
Okay.
And if I just run it, it already has built into it a place to go test. And Microsoft has a server on the internet that this thing can go ping. Now, I don't have a clear internet connection here, so I can't. I'll let it fail here in just
fail
a second.
Fail time out and tell you there's a problem.
It's going to go out and basically do a ping and try and figure out if that server's online and give you back some relatively interesting statistics. This one failed, which is fine. I'm going to go ahead and have it ping a machine that I know is up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do a test. Net connection. And so it gives you back, just a little bit sort of more organized information. Because in PowerShell, you can actually make decisions based on it. And you go, oh, ping, I don't want to type test net connection. I don't want to type all that. So, it's a great thing about PowerShell. You can alias it. So there's a TNC is the alias. And here's where this thing gets really interesting. You can ping a port with this tool. This is what gets me excited. And if you happen to pick a port that doesn't work, 55, it just fails. But it gets even better than that. You can do a traceroute. and it'll actually trace the entire. Now, I'm on the same subnet as 1-hop, so I'm not getting a trace. And you can have all kinds of fun with this, right? The you know, this is more than a ping, so I call this a super ping. So we can super ping it. Or, you know, there's I think we got a ping. Ping-a-ling-a-ding-dong. That's a fun one. Or like if you're kind of like a sci-fi comic book, I can go X-ping. The point is, you can have all kinds of fun with this, right? You'll be the coolest ping guy at the party because nice. You have X-ping or super ping. And these are all aliases, by the way, that I created within PowerShell. But NCP, you know, I did some job interviews for people a little while ago, and one of the questions is, you know, the first vetting question is like, okay, give me an IP address on the internet. I can ping to see if I got a web connection right now. Rick, go. Give me an IP address on the internet. I can ping. I bet someone will type it in the chat window.
142.7.7.1.
142.77. What?
142.77.1.1.
I never heard of that DNS for
one of the old ISP providers up in Canada I used to use.
Oh, fair enough. Are they still around?
Yeah.
Okay.
You'll answer if you ping it.
888-4221-4222.
Nice. Right.
If you can't tell me that, I mean, you've never had to sit and troubleshoot a network. But an acceptable answer nowadays would be NCP. Because it would go ping Microsoft's endpoint, which is like an MS Edge dot something network. Yeah. So that's a new little tool that's in 2012 R2 and Windows 8.1 that I just completely dig. So I want to show you.
Nice. Scenario summary. We're over time here, so I want to wrap this one up. Basically, advanced software network defining where this is, where it sits right now, delivering continuously available applications through a variety of new different solutions that are part of Server 2012, improved networking performance because we now have the ability to expose some of the hardware acceleration into the VMs and into the virtual world with the existing hardware vendors. The ability to go through and do a data center level management because you're abstracting and managing your fabrics with things like SCVMM. People go off and do stuff, and then finally connecting up to the hybrid cloud. And last little bit of a wrap-up that we have from a slide perspective, once again, is the MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com for some additional stuff. There is a great amount of information available on channel9.msdn.com/event/TechEd North America and TechEd Europe.
Absolutely.
To be able to go off and get some more detailed sessions on this. We'll be right back after the break.
After the break. See you soon.
And we're going to be answering some questions in the queue as we can, exactly. Now that we have some time to be able to do that.
Some of them might even be accurate. How long is the break? 15, 20, 30, 45
minutes? Well, for those of you that are live, we're going to say it's going to be about 15.
About 15 minutes.
But for those of you that are online, you just simply hit play on the next one.
Okay. It's 10 minutes.
Oh, 10 minutes, according to our producer on the other side of the camera.
He's sitting back there doing this.
10 minutes. I thought there was wait.
Yeah.
I thought there was wait.
No, 10 minutes. 10-minute break.
So we'll be back.